From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Film historian Janine Basinger is my guest. Her excellent books include A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960, Silent Stars, and The Star Machine. She's also provided some fine audio commentaries on a bunch of DVDs. Her latest book is I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. Janine Basinger, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I enjoyed your book very much. And before we get into the specifics of your book, I have some just kind of general movie questions that your book sparked in my head.
Oh, great.
You know, given that the production code was so restrictive, you would think that the era after the demise of the code, that is the present day, you know, would result in movies that are far more interesting. But that, to me, doesn't seem to be the case. What do you think?
Well, no, I mean, it's always, I mean, when one has freedom to depict relationships between men and women or the ills of society more accurately or openly or freely, movies get a jolt of energy and believability that is always better. I think the remarkable thing about the After the Code era is how cleverly Hollywood actually worked up a kind of coded language with the audience for what they wanted to tell them. I mean, when a couple make a passionate kiss and one cuts to the fireplace flames or the crashing waves or fireworks, you know, nobody's not getting it. You know what I mean? It was very clever the way they did create a way of saying what they wanted to say to people. But, I mean, I do think that the movies had a lot more pizzazz when there wasn't the code.
I guess that's true with violence, too. They found clever ways of depicting
violence.
Yes,
and in some ways, those indicators are more horrifying. You know, when they cut away and petals are floating on water when the little girl was throwing things in with Frankenstein, or, you know, just things that they do that make you think about what is happening more specifically. I mean, if they don't show the sex, you have to do it in your head. If they don't show the murder, you kind of do it in your head, you know. So in a way, your involvement is heightened. I think they were highly skilled at maintaining audience commitment and understanding even when they had restrictions.
Yeah, I always think of that scene with Boris Karloff in Scarface where he's bowling.
Yeah,
he rolls the bowling ball down the alley, and the Howard Hawk stays with the bowling ball, and you hear the machine guns come and get him.
And you see the axes. And I mean, I really, that's a great example.
Well, you know, that's the fun thing about your book. It made me think about all the movies and talk about movies with all my friends. And I guess that's what your book is all about. Another question I had for you. I teach film appreciation at Monterey Peninsula College, and you are the head of the film department at your university. Do your students find older films less interesting than newer films?
No. I mean, I have to say, I am blessed to be able to say my students find older films far more interesting, and they frequently complain about the newer films, the lack of cinematic imagination, the flatter, more, kind of like a TV movie that a lot of the talking movies, however well written they might be, I'm very fortunate. We have an actual film major, and we have had it for a few decades. And the students who come to study where I'm teaching really come because they are motivated by a serious study of the history and theory of old films, and also to make films in the great tradition of American filmmaking. So fortunately, I hope that it isn't true that your students don't like the older ones, is it?
It is, actually. I mean, I don't know. They haven't seen enough of them. But when one of the first assignments I give is to write your top 10, what are your all-time favorite movies? And many of them have movies that came out last Thursday on their list, you know.
It's frightening.
And there was a movie, actually, that I watched the other night because it was on so many 10 best lists of my students, which was called End of Watch. And it wasn't a terrible, horrible movie, although...
No, it's not. It's not a bad one. I mean, by today's standards, it's actually a pretty good movie, but...
But it's not but it's not very good in the scheme of things. I think one of the things I noticed is that nowadays, because cutting is so easily done, you just right-click and...
And you, I assume,
as opposed to taking a piece of film and cutting it and putting a piece of tape on it, that there's so much cutting now that watching older films seems, my students tell me, this movie is slow, like, you know, Rear Window is slow.
You're scaring me seriously here, Gary.
Oh, they tell me this all the time. That's terrible. But I think it's maybe due to this, to the judicious use of cutting in older films.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, we actually make all of our students are required to both study production, learn how to make films, and study history and serious analysis, formal analysis. But our students learn on 16 millimeter, they cut on old flatbeds. We make them learn it the old-fashioned way. We make them learn handmade editing, so that they have to think, they have to explore possibilities, including long takes. We give them long take exercises as well as, you know, fast cutting exercises. So when they, then it takes them about 45 minutes to an hour to master, you know, obviously editing with a computer process. And they then, they aren't thinking, they've learned to think like filmmakers of the past. Why am I cutting? What is the point of this? What is my goal? And I do think when students are learning history or seeing old films, and they're also at the same time learning editing the old-fashioned way, they start to understand and have a different feeling about it. And of course, you know, Alfred Hitchcock in many of his films have has an average shot length in scenes, some scenes of about 7.9 seconds. I mean, he's a pretty fast cutter, and he was a montage artist, you know. So sometimes it helps them, you know, when they're putting the two things together. And that was really the idea of our major, is that you will both learn to understand viewing one and making one and the relation between the two, so that you can see that there are a lot of options and it's not just about something flashing by rapidly in front of you. And you know, I fully believe because I know you love film, that by the time the students leave your class, they've gained an appreciation for a slower form. It's just hard to get them to do it, right?
I try.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. That's all we can do. You know, that's sort of a definition of modern education. We try. There's a lot of distractions out there, but we try. That's all we can do.
That's true. We're talking with Janine Basinger, and she's one of the great film historians, and her new book is so much fun. It's called I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. And I liked how you kind of challenged me at the beginning, because you said you asked your friends to tell you marriage movies and they couldn't think of any. And so I thought of a few. We'll talk about those in a bit. But I want to ask you, do you think that Hollywood, the studios chose to not talk about marriage or not mention marriage because they felt that they weren't interested in marriage, or because they were sure that the audience were not interested in marriage?
I think it's a combination of those things. I think that, first of all, they weren't sure that this would be a glamorous, sexy topic for audiences. I think they felt, well, this is the story the audience knows, and it's also the story they know better than we do, is probably what they were thinking. And they knew that people liked to have something glamorous, something exciting, something different, something exotic, something out there when they went to the movies, something to take them out of their everyday lives. So I think they worried about it. I also don't think it was the topic that they were themselves particularly interested in. And, you know, obviously we all know Hollywood hasn't had a great track record in a successful marriage over the decades, although, you know, so I think they felt wary of this topic. It's also a story form that doesn't lend itself well to screenwriting. I mean, it doesn't have a natural story arc. Marriage, if it's successful, is a very day-to-day, calm, collected, regular kind of thing. And so, you know, where's your drama? You have to take it and turn it into a roller coaster ride. And so in order to really make it interesting, they were going to have to destroy it and wreck it in some way. And I think maybe that bothered them, you know. It was just something that they had other story forms that appealed, it seemed easier to do, and possibly seemed much easier to sell.
And yet you discovered in your studies that there clearly is a genre called marriage movies. They just don't call it that.
That's right. And also, not only that, marriage is all over movies. I mean, of the films that are definitely about marriage do exist. They are there. They just weren't labeled by the business that way. But pick up a Western, pick up a gangster film, right in the middle of it, suddenly there'll be a conversation about marriage and how terrible it is or how hard it is or how wonderful it would be. I mean, marriage is everywhere, but just sort of not there. It was a very peculiar discovery that I made in doing this. I was kind of surprised by it, really.
And, well, so how did you come up with the idea to write this one?
You know, I look back and I say to myself, why did I do this? Because actually, it was kind of difficult. But in my book on the woman's film, I had written a chapter on men and marriage. And I had looked at some very interesting marriage films that really seemed very modern to me. And they had kind of stuck with me. And I liked looking at those and studying them. And I thought, you know, that would be something I would be interested in writing on. And I do have to say that I consider myself an expert here in one way. I do have impeccable credentials. I've been married 45 years and also to the same man. It's not 45 years of marriage with 7 or 8 guys. I've stuck it out with one. So, you know, I often think about...
Just the one husband then?
Yeah, that's right. 45 years, one husband, nearly 46 years. And I think people often ask us, why does your marriage work? You know, why is your marriage working? And I think, well, I don't know. You know, I don't really think about it that way. But then I got interested in the topic, and then once I started it, it really held me. And it took me a long time to actually do this book. It was challenging to take a hold of something that the business itself was a kind of in denial about. So I'm happy that you liked the book. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I have to get you to talk about some of the surprising choices that you make, because you talked about the ideal wife being Myrna Loy, and everybody always says, oh, Myrna Loy, but your ideal husband.
W.C. Fields. Or who?
Yes, W.C. Fields.
Right.
I love that scene in It's a Gift when his wife is talking to him and she won't stop talking, and the telephone rings.
Hospital. They wanted to know if this was the maternity hospital.
Oh,
Now you change it.
No, I didn't change it, dear. I told you they asked me if this was the maternity
hospital. Oh, don't make it any worse.
They asked me if...
I don't know how you expect anybody to get any sleep hopping in and out of bed all night, tinkering round the house, waiting up for telephone calls. You have absolutely no consideration for anybody but yourself.
I love that. And also, you know, that really that is the classic beleaguered husband. The wonderful thing, the reason I connected him so as I was accidentally watching some Myrna Loy films and really thinking, you know, she's the perfect wife because she's the fun mate. She's the girlfriend, the eternal date, the pal. But she also, as a wife, she forbears. You know, she kind of doesn't nag. She lifts an eyebrow. She maybe makes a little wiggle of her nose or something, but she forbears. She moves on. She lets it be. And feels, who is always a husband, being completely nagged and just completely treated like dirt, sort of forbears in his own way. And I was teaching a course on comedy during this time, and I was showing my students It's a Gift, and I suddenly thought, here's the perfect husband, you know, and so I had fun with that.
And then you also mentioned the perfect married couple in the movies being the ideal depiction of a married couple.
Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
Some people don't get... Well, you know, the thing about Laurel and Hardy, who I'm a big Laurel and Hardy fan. I think they're fabulous. But I watch them a lot, and I thought about the way they understand each other's rhythm. Laurel and Hardy move through their short films and their features with a kind of body rhythm and tempo that is perfectly timed to the other. They bicker endlessly. Bicker, 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 like most married couples do. They're always dissatisfied, cranking at each other. It's never working. But let some force from the outside come at them, they immediately pull together and just know each other's moves, and they act together perfectly. They have that kind of language between them that couples who've been married a long time have. I can tell by the way my husband puts his spoon down on his coffee cup, on his saucer, if we're out at a dinner party, that he wants to go home and soon, you know? And I sort of saw that in Laurel and Hardy, and I thought it was kind of fun. They are wedded in a way that a couple who stay together a long time are wedded, and I found that interesting, visually interesting.
And the scene that you chose to use the example of them dancing together, and just you conjured it up so perfectly. I didn't have to find Way Out West because I could just see it in my head the way you described it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Look at it. It will give you such a joy to see them do that little number. It really, it's really fabulous.
Now, I noticed that there's some marriage movies that are disguised as other kinds of movies. There was there were a couple of biopics that came to my mind that are, I think, are marriage movies, even though they're obviously biopics. One of them is Pride of the Yankees, which is clearly the story of Lou Gehrig, but the it doesn't start so much, it's not so much about Lou Gehrig as a little boy or whatever, it's mostly about his relationship with his wife.
Absolutely right, and of course she was the advisor on the film, I believe, the story of Lou Gehrig was really turned into as much of a marriage movie as it was a baseball movie, but its primary focus is baseball, is his baseball career and the tragedy of his disease and death. So that is how it was sold and billed. When you look at it, and I think that's very astute of you, and I completely agree, it's actually the story of his marriage and even his wife's trouble with his mother-in-law problems, you know, mother-in-law problem.
Yeah.
But see, there's an example of, you know, they didn't sell it as a marriage movie. They did they did sell it with the idea of a love story between the two of them, but they didn't talk. They talked about love and baseball, two things we Americans like, but they didn't talk too much about marriage in the advertising. But that's a good example.
Gary Cooper and Teresa Wright are both so great in it.
They are.
She's a marvelous actress. And I guess also by having it be from her perspective, it amplifies the tragedy of his young death.
Yes, and it also gives a sense of life to the picture, to her going on, keeping the tradition, keeping the awareness of his heroics alive, and it kind of tempers that at the end, you know, and it celebrates life then in a way that it could have been more of a downer than it was otherwise, I think.
That's an example of an I Do, and another biopic that I think is similar is Houdini with Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh.
Yes, and that's a great idea. You know, I looked at a lot of biopics about married couples, and one I really liked was I'll See You in My Dreams with Doris Day and Danny Thomas, the Gus Kahn story. But I had already written about that in my women's book, and I decided, you know, that I shouldn't do that. But Houdini is a great idea, and, you know, I actually have seen that film. I ushered for that film. I saw it probably what feels like 5,000 times, and I didn't think of it. You were smart to think of that. Yeah, but that's a good example, definitely.
Oh, now I thought of an I Don't that's a biopic, and that's the Jolson story. Which, like the Houdini movie, are a completely fictitious rendering of the life of the guy. But a big portion of the Jolson story is his relationship with his mythical wife.
Yes, who they couldn't call Ruby Keeler because Ruby Keeler wouldn't give them the permission.
They call her Julie, I believe.
Yes, right. And then she danced out of... When they did Jolson Sings Again... You know, they started by saying she danced out of his life, and of course we had seen her walk out at the end. But that was an enormously popular film, the Jolson story, huge box office hit, even an Academy Award nomination for Larry Parks, which really is a downer about the marriage, but suggests that career had to be everything for him. That's unusual. That's an unusual way for a film to end. But they didn't have any choice because everybody knew about Jolson and Keeler, of course.
I love how in your book, Jeanine Basinger, you talked about television as well as movies.
Yes. Well, there's a point where the marriage story actually moves over to TV. And because there are so many married couple sitcoms and situations on TV, it was partly not necessary for movies to tell that story. And also, it was a competition, so movies started trying to do something else in a way. But I think you can't really talk about a marriage story in America and ignore TV after a certain point.
I guess you could say the same thing about the Western. That is, once television came in and they had so many Westerns, that Westerns kind of faded from the big screen.
Yeah, that's true. You know, TV kind of, there was a time when there was almost nothing on TV but Westerns. I mean, they were the single most popular long and short form, and then they just got less interesting to people accordingly on the big screen, which I love Westerns, so I'm always sorry. They keep trying to bring them back, and great Westerns were certainly made after the 60s. I mean, you have all the Sergio Leones, you have the Clint Eastwoods, you have a lot of great Westerns still, but not like the golden days.
Naturally. You wrote a book about Anthony Mann, one of the great...
I did, yes. I love Anthony Mann's movies.
He kind of made film noir Westerns.
Yeah, I love them. They're wonderful. His Devil's Doorway, The Furies, these are great movies.
Very great. You know, now I'm thinking, are there marriage Westerns? Would you say that Kitty Russell and Matt Dillon are kind of a married couple.
They are, and also, you know, in Shane, the marriage is a very key factor. You don't think when you hear the word Shane, marriage movie, and you don't think when you hear High Noon, marriage movie.
Oh, but that
and
one
yet,
definitely is a marriage
they
movie.
They definitely are, and they're major factors. The marriage is a major factor, a major impact on the hero's life in both of those movies. And that's sort of true in Anthony Mann's film, The Ten Star. I mean,
Henry Fonda, and
of course the film Westward, the women are going west to get married. I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of fringe things, but the main focus, you know, again, they don't sell it that way, but they were always aware of marriage in people's lives. And as I said, marriage turns up everywhere. In a combat film in which no women are going to appear, the men are often discussing marriage, their wives back home or their dreams of marriage or their girlfriend or what marriage is like, or, you know, it's a peculiar thing. It's an ever-present topic, but yet often not the main focus of the movie story or genre.
Gay marriage hasn't quite made... I think maybe they should do a remake of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and have it be a gay marriage.
That's what they need to do, yes. It's interesting that they've still skirted around that quite a bit. The Kids Are All Right, I think, was, you know, the major mainstream kind of success movie about gay marriage. The plot of it, interestingly, could have, except for the sperm donating, which is modern, could have been, you know, Kay Francis and George Brent in the 1930s had two kids who, and they were adopted, and, you know, they go and find the birth mother. I mean, you know, the plot wasn't what was new so much about Kids Are All Right. What was new was the gay marriage and the sperm donor. So, you know, you fix up old plots with new things, I guess.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great to see it with Kay Francis and Irene Dunn?
Oh, yes. That would have been... Now, there's a movie I would go to right this minute. I would hang up on you and go to that. Yes.
This wonderful book, and we haven't talked enough about it at all, but everybody should go, if you love movies, you should go get this book. It's got a fabulous picture of Jimmy Stewart and Carol Lombard on the cover. It's called I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. Janine Basinger is the author. She's brilliant, and the book is a lot of fun. And thank you so much for spending a little time with us on From the Bookshelf.
I want to thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to talk to someone who really loves and knows old movies the way you do. I hope that you'll call me again sometime, even when I don't have a book.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Janine Basinger, her book, I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.